Thanks, Juan, for the introduction, and also thank you for the invitation to give the Strong Gravity seminar for you all today. So I organized a presentation in which I'll try to cover a little bit this topic of spontaneous black hole scarization, which has been one of my main research topics in the last couple of years. I'll try to start with some motivation, especially when it comes to why consider theories of gravity beyond general relativity. I'll give you an overview about what spontaneous black hole scarization is. I'll give you a little bit of an overview of what are the consequences of this phenomena. And then I will discuss some more recent work that I've done regarding the effects of spin and also what happens when you have binary black hole systems. So this work, of course, wasn't done by myself alone, and I've been quite fortunate to collaborate with a lot of people whose names you see here. So it's quite a group effort to explore this effect. So to get started, as the title hints, we will probably be talking about black holes, but outside general relativity, because we know that black holes in GR, they do not have hair. So let me start motivating a little bit the question of first experimental relativity and then modified gravity. So up to now, we have been testing general relativity on quite a wide set of scales, and I want to briefly overview them. I want to touch base on cosmology, unfortunately, during this presentation, but I'll focus more on astrophysical scenarios. So it's quite interesting to test general relativity because it's one of the fundamental theories of modern physics. It serves as basis for our understanding of nature. And it's always nice to remind that quote by Feynman that it does not make any difference how smart you are, who made the guess, or what his name is. If the theory that someone proposed disagrees with the experiment, then it's wrong. And that is all there is to it. So motivated by this type of thinking, people have tested general relativity in various different scenarios, which following a paper by Norbert Wex, I was splitting four categories like so. The first diagram here corresponds to the regimes of gravity where you have small velocities and weak fields. So this is the situation that you find in the solar system, and we have tools for testing gravity in this scenario, for instance, the PPN formalism, and everything works quite well. The next step is this regime where you have mild velocities relative to the speed of light and you have stronger gravitational fields. For instance, this is what you find when you have a system of binary compact objects, say a neutron star and a white dwarf as shown in this cartoon. General relativity is doing quite well on this as well. And then we have this more scenario which we have just started exploring. Actually, it's been 5 years since the announcement of the first gravitational wave event today. And we have started to test the predictions of general relativity in this high velocity, strong field regime as that you find in at the Leighton spiral merger of binary black holes. And we also, of course, probing the radiative regime of the theory through gravitational waves. And general relativity has been doing quite well in all these scales. But there are certain reasons to continue testing relativity aside from the ones that I've mentioned already, that it's one of the underlying theories that we use to understand nature. Well, this is the first item that I just said. We know that rather than a full complete theory of quantum gravity, and we know that general relativity is non-renormalizable, and therefore you can attempt to quantize it by adding modifications to it. And it's actually, this is a natural prediction of grand unification theory, such as string theory, for instance, that at the low energy limit, you have general relativity plus extra content. We also have certain motivations coming from cosmology, such as to explain why we see this late time acceleration at the current rate that we observe in the universe. Why it's that? Maybe it's a modification of general relativity at the infrared regime. It's also interesting to do tests in general relativity as a means of performing unbiased tests of gravity. So instead of assuming that general relativity is correct, you can try to compare your observation against predictions from other theories and see how it performs relative to general relativity. And also it's interesting from a purely theoretical perspective. Sometimes studying something beyond general relativity actually brings you better understanding and appreciation for the original theory that you were looking at. So the way to go beyond general relativity is there are certain ways that you can modify Einstein's theory. One way that I like thinking about it is to take as a reference point this theorem due to Lovelock that says essentially that if you are in four-dimensional space, you demand that your field equations are at most of second order, and you have a single metric tensor, and you impose a diffeomorphism invariance. The only theory that you can construct that has this property is general relativity. So as it often happens, if you are given a theorem, you can start relaxing the assumptions that go into it, and then you start building out other theories of gravity. So in this context, you can imagine some sort of Lovelock cube that I'll walk you through now. So for instance, you can change the field content. You can think that maybe gravity is not described just by a spin two field or a metric tensor. It might have scalar, it might have vector fields. And you can go in one of the axes here, away from GR. You can change the dimensionality of space-time. You can break Lorentz symmetry as well, if you prefer. You can break parity invariance, which also is assumed in general relativity. And this defines a little hypercube of gravity theories that you can start populating with your theories. And I'm sure some of you have studied some of this yourself. Things such as Hondesky gravity, Broca theories, by gravity theories would fit in this context. Other ones like Horava-Lifshitz introduce both field content and Brayton-Lorentz symmetry, level of gravity changes dimensionality. And you have variation, dynamical Chern-Simons and variations thereof that introduce field content and break parity. What I'll be talking to you today is theories which change the field content. And in particular, I'll be talking about theories in which you have a scalar degree of freedom and that decouples with higher curvature operators in certain ways that I'll tell you more in a moment. Now, given this, you can start about exploring what are the consequences of these various theories. And you can hope that experimental observational guidance will tell you exactly where in this corner of this hypercube the universe we live in is actually at. So let me give you an example of what happens when you relax the assumption that general relativity is the correct theory to describe gravity. And it's an example that will serve as basis for what I'm going to talk about later. So consider neutron stars, which are stars which have very strong gravitational fields. They are next to black holes, they are the strongest sources of gravitational fields that we know of. So they are very good to test or to examine what happens when you relax assumptions of general relativity in scalar tensor theory in a very simple model. So there is a very simple subset of scalar tensor theories which qualitatively you can understand as follows. So the theory still has some metric tensor, that I'm shown here by the grid. There's also a scalar field which lives on top of the of your metric. It can have some gradients and is shown here by the colors. And then you construct out of it some metric of this form where you have some coupling function A of the scalar field, and this is the original metric. For those of you who are more familiar with this topic, this refers to the Jordan frame metric, which is the frame in which self-gravitating bodies will follow the geodesic head. So in this type of scalar tensor fields of gravity, you have that matter determines what is the metric in the scalar field. Then you can construct this metric, and then this tells how matter behaves. So there's a very interesting choice that you can make in this type of theory for this function A, which leads to some interesting effect. Let me pause here for a second, explain too fast. And it predicts some quite dramatic changes on the structure of neutron stars. So I will choose a function A given by this form, an exponential of beta. Beta is a coupling constant, a dimensionless coupling constant, and phi is the scalar field. It's the same phi as this one, so it's the scalar field. And then I'll show you what happens as you crank down this value of beta and what is an influence on the mass and radius predicted for neutron stars in scalar tensor theory relative to general relativity, which is the solid line here. So each point along this mass radius curve corresponds to a neutron star. This is what I'll show on the left panel. On the right panel, I'll show you the value of the scalar field at the core of the star as a function of the mass. So if you start computing neutron star solutions in this theory, you see that nothing happens as I turn this value of beta here until you reach a certain point. Let me go back like so, in which you start seeing the appearance of a non-zero scalar field configuration within the star, which predicts larger and larger differences with respect to the general relativity counterpart as you make this value smaller and smaller. So basically you have that in this theory is the neutron star is now endowed with a monopolar scalar field configuration like so, with some associated scalar charge, which leads to some observational consequences, for instance, in binary systems, which was studied by some people here. And moreover, it only happens for certain range of star compactnesses here. So you see that even in scalar tensor theory with this large value here of this parameter beta, the red curve overlaps with the GR1 down here. So you have a situation where certain stars do not have hair and some which do. This effect of this sudden appearance of a scalar field configuration where certain conditions are met, certain conditions on mass, as you can see here, and certain conditions on the coupling parameters, you can see here, is called spontaneous discolorization. This is the field equation for the theory. I don't think we need this at the moment, but this is quite a well-known effect that was first predicted in the 90s. And for a long time, people never asked the question if it was possible to extend these ideas for the case of black holes. Historically, I don't know why that was the case, but we decided to answer this question some years back. So to see if this is possible, it's quite a good reference point to look at the equation that the scalar field satisfies in this class of scalar tensor theories. It has this certain form. Then now let's take a look at the next slide. Oh, sorry, actually, there's something else that I wanted to say. So perhaps one of the reasons that people did not look at this originally is that we have no Hare theorems in scalar tensor theories. So basically, these theorems say that even in scalar tensor theories, black holes will be described only by the mass and the spin, and they will have at most a trivial scalar field profile that doesn't do anything to the spacetime. So its gradient is equal to zero. Now, you can always relax this as the assumptions that go into proving the theorems to endow black hole with certain amount of Hare. Some of these violations of no Hare theorems have been done by introducing matter fields around the black hole. For instance, if you put in the same scalar tensor theory model that I was describing to you, if you add an accretion disk around it, you could trigger the appearance of Hare around the black hole. This was shown by Cardoso et al. In 2014. You can also break symmetries between what you assume for your background spacetime and for the scalar field. This was done by Dale and Hadou in 2014. There are also two other ways that you could go about, which is to introduce couplings between the scalar field and higher curvature quantities in the action of your theory, as done by Kanti and others since the 90s. But really, we try to focus on something that is very akin to the spontaneous scalarization of neutron stars that I showed to you in the previous slide. And this was done by two different groups in 2017. So to set up the stage, let me remind you of what the equation looked like for the scalar field, which is the key player here. In the scalar tensor theory that I was telling you about a few slides back, it has this form. Beta is the same coupling constant that I showed to you. Phi is the scalar field, and T here is the trace of the energy momentum tensor. Now, if you want to generalize something like this for black holes, obviously you cannot have T here because you're in vacuum. But then you remind yourself, quoting Chandrasekhar, that that black holes are, the construction only depend on concepts of space and time. And therefore, thinking about general relativity and curved space-time, you naturally led to think about replacing the trace of the energy momentum tensor by some curvature quantity, let's call it C, with some coupling F of phi, like so, some curvature. And then once you take this step, you are led to the question that, well, what can I put here for C? There are certain options. You could choose, say, the Gauss-Bonnet invariant. You could choose the Pontryagin density. You could not choose Ricci, for instance, because, say, a Schwarzschild black hole is Ricci flat, so it's equal to zero. So you need something, at least like a Kretschmann scalar here, if you want to proceed in this direction. But once you have this, you can start wondering if you can have some effect akin to what I showed to you for neutron stars, but for black holes, but where now the certain appearance of the scalar field is induced by curvature, not by matter anymore. So, okay. So let me show you a concrete model for this. So in, and this here should be 17. So in the, so we look it into a theory, which is described by the following action, where you have the usual Einstein-Hilbert term. You include a kinetic term for your scalar field phi. And you have some generic coupling F of phi with the Gauss-Bonnet invariant G. The equation for the scalar field that follows from this action is the following. And then we show that there are certain results that if you demand certain things, you impose certain restrictions on the coupling function F of phi. So for instance, if you demand the existence of GR solutions, you need to impose that there is some constant scalar field phi for which the derivative of the coupling constant evaluated at it is equal to zero, because then you have that the both sides of the equation are equal to zero. You can further show that the curve family of solution is a solution of this theory as well, if this condition is met of the second derivative of the scalar field phi. I'll explain this in a moment and show some cases where this is violated later. But let's take a look at this quantity here and see what does this mean in practice. So taking this, this thing here, it means that if you assumed so, you note that GR is a solution of this equation. So you have box phi zero equal to zero, and here you have zero as well. Now that second condition is equivalent to a condition on an effective mass of some scalar field perturbation as follows. So imagine that you have a Schwarzschild black hole and you have this constant scalified solution living on top of it. This is a solution of the full theory that I was describing to you in the previous slide. Then you perturb it a little bit with some delta phi and you try to find what is the equation that governs the evolutions of your delta phi. If you take the equation that I showed you before and do this, you do a linearization, you find that delta phi satisfies this condition. And then you identify this quantity here as being some effective mass like so, which is interesting because the effective mass depends on the coupling constant that I'll introduce in a moment, and also on the value of the curvature of the black hole spacetime. So you're led to think that if I combine these things in a certain way, I might make this effective mass squared negative, which will lead to some instability that will drive your GR solution into something else, which is the avenue that I will explore now. Okay, so given this background, let me show you a concrete model in which all of this happens. So we take f of phi, the coupling function in your action that multiplies the Gauss-Bonnet invariant. And we do some, you know, a Taylor series expansion around your background F naught. This first term here, when multiplied by the Gauss-Bonnet invariant, gives a total divergence and therefore it doesn't contribute to the field equation. So we can drop this. The second term goes away by our assumption that we want the GR solutions to remain solutions of this scalar Gauss-Bonnet theory that we are looking at. So this bit goes away. And then we are led to the conclusion that the minimal bit that you need is this one. A concrete example that you can choose for it is a quadratic coupling. So therefore its second derivative is non-zero. And if you do the calculation that I showed to you and compute what is the effective mass for scalar field perturbations around a GR solution, given this choice of your coupling constant, you find that it has this quantity here. So for a Schwarzschild black hole, we know that the Gauss-Bonnet invariant is positive definite everywhere and is given by this quantity, which means that if I choose this quantity eta here to be positive, the effective mass squared is negative, and therefore you have the possibility of realizing this stability that we are searching for. So let me show you in some plots this more concretely. I've been talking about instability, but it might be sounding a bit fake what I mean by that up to this moment. So let me do a little experiment. I will take the wave equation for the scalar field in this theory and do a time domain numerical evolution of it. So the box phi satisfied this equation, just to recap, where the effective mass is proportional to this coupling constant eta and the Gauss-Bonnet invariant. And then I'm going to take the perturbations and do the usual decomposition into radial, temporal and radial parts and the spherical harmonics. And I'm going to look at the monopole perturbations, L equal M equal to zero. So let's see what happens. So I'm going to show you a few snapshots of, well, a few selection of curves of this quantity sigma that appears here, you know, decomposition of the perturbations for L equal M equal to zero at some observation point very far away from the black hole. And I'm going to set initial data as a Gaussian pulse. So you have a pulse of scalar field that travels towards the black hole and it interacts with it. And then you observe in its magnitude far away from the black hole at some observation point. And I'm going to show to you what happens, what you would see as a function of time. So in the case of GI, if you do this experiment, you will see the very characteristic ring down signal, like so, with some ringing here and then a power law tail. And then if you start making eta non-zero, as say half of this value here, and I'll explain what this is in a moment, but you see that first having this eta non-zero lead to some modification here in the ring down, but the tail is still, you know, the scalar field still decays over time after scattering off at the black hole. But there's a critical value for eta, which is given by this numerical value here, in which the scalar field simply flattens out. And if you're slightly above this critical value, you see that instability, the scalar field starts growing in time once you go a little bit above this critical value. So the, as I said, this is the GR curve. So it's equivalent to the classic computational experiment by Vishwasvara in the 70s. The green line tells you that the scalar field is stable. The green line where you see this flattening means that you form a time-independent scalar field around the black hole. And I'll call this a bound state. And then in this situation where you went above the this critical magnitude of the coupling constant, you saw that the scalar field is unstable. So we have found that then that if you consider a Schwarzschild black hole and you put the scalar field coupled with the Gauss-Bonnet invariant in the way that I, with this quadratic coupling that I showed to you, if you make the coupling constant with a certain value, the scalar field becomes unstable on top of Schwarzschild. And then you can wonder what is the linear, non-linear consequence of this scalar field growth that is, you know, increasing with time. So we also computed what happens, and then you find this thing that we call the spontaneously scalarized black holes. So there are several interesting features of this. So in here, I'm not looking at the linearized regime anymore. We actually solved the full equations of the theory. And some of the consequences that we find is that black holes in this theory, they only exist within certain mass ranges, in the sense that if I fix the coupling constant of the theory, this eta, which I forgot to mention, sorry, that it's a dimensionful quantity. So I'm plotting here in units of solar mass. If you fix it, black holes with scalar here, they only happen within a certain band. So for instance, if the value of eta was this, only black holes with this mass range here will be scalarized. This is very similar to what we saw in the case of neutron stars, if you remember. And the solutions are also characterized by the number of nodes that they have. So this is the fundamental solution, and these are examples of solutions with different number of nodes, and they exist in these other bands here. So it's very much like levels of, say, a quantum mechanical system. So you have this discretized set of scalarized solutions. And these are followed by some, again, bands where the scalar charge of the black hole is non-zero, and this could lead to some observational consequences, for instance, in binaries. From my perspective, I think the most striking difference of this class of theories is that in contrast with these other cases that have been extensively studied in the literature before, in our case, black holes only have hair within a certain mass range, while in this theories here, you always have, black holes always have some hair. So this theories here, they do not admit the GR solutions. That is quite an interesting feature. And as far as I know, I don't know of any other fear, modified fear of gravity that has this features like so.
So Hector, can I ask a question here? So is there any constraint or motivation for the particular form of FI? I mean, and like some of them may be like favorable over some other choice? Or is it completely open?
The choice of phi that we use, it's the basically the simplest one that will lead to the features that we are trying to find, basically. If you were to look from motivation coming from high energy physics, for instance, this will be the choices which are favorable. And in particular, this one comes from some low energy limits of string theory. But as far as I can tell, a phi square coupling do not arise from any theory like so.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I could interrupt to ask a question too. Yeah. So you were saying, you know, if you fix a certain length scale for this coupling parameter, and there's only a range of masses for black holes where you can find these scalarized solutions. Mm-hmm. But then if you consider black holes that are smaller than that, are they still unstable? And it's just that the theory breaks down and you can't find a scalarized solution?
What you find is that then you don't have solutions with scalar hair. The solution is Schwarzschild.
But is Schwarzschild still stable? Those like small mass Schwarzschild solutions, are they stable in the presence of a small scalar perturbation?
Yes, exactly. They will still be stable. It's just like in the plot that I showed in the previous slide, where I had eta non-zero but small below this critical value, and you saw that at late times the scalar field still decayed in time.
Yeah, but I'm saying you turn up eta. Mm-hmm. At some point it becomes unstable, and then you're saying if you turn it even larger, it then becomes stable again?
Okay, I see. So what happens is that if you keep increasing the value of eta at the nonlinear level, when you're looking at the behavior of the scalar field very close to the horizon, you find that there is an upper limit for the magnitude of the scalar field at the horizon. If you want to avoid the scale of its first derivative to diverge. So at the nonlinear level, you cannot make the scalar field at the horizon arbitrarily large, and this puts a limit. It sets one of the edges of this curve.
But then the smaller mass black holes are still unstable. It's just that the theory breaks down because they have nothing to evolve to.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So it's not like this theory, like, I mean, it still has strong, like, predicts strong effects for even smaller black holes. It's just that in some sense, they're so strong that the theory itself breaks down.
Yeah, I think I think if you were to decrease the mass further, you would have a very, very, very stronger instability. And maybe the very fast growth of the scalar field breaks the theory down, maybe.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thanks. Okay. So, this is the basic picture. For the non-rotating black hole case, let me just mention that there are a few other couplings that have been studied as well. We work it out a minimum EFT model in this paper, where you include other operators of the same order of this phi squared g to the action, and the stability of this non-rotating solutions have also been studied in a series of paper specifically by Blasque Salcedo and his collaborators. Now, all of this is for non-rotating black holes. So let me tell you a little bit what happens when you add spin. So let's think again about this linear regime where you have a test scalar field obeying this, having this effective mass on top of a GR background. But now let's substitute this by Schwarzschild and replace it. Let's substitute Schwarzschild by Kerr and see what happens. So this case is quite interesting because if you were to analyze the Gauss-Bonnet invariant in, say, in some Cartesian coordinates here as a function of spin, you find that if it is below 0.5, it's okay. Let me explain the curves first. So the outer curve is the outer horizon. This is the inner horizon, and there's a constant Gauss-Bonnet equal to zero. So it's the nodes. So for instance, if I am the Gauss-Bonnet invariant will be positive here, and if you move it here, it's equal to zero. It becomes negative, zero, and then positive. So if the spin is about 0.5 and below this, the Gauss-Bonnet is always positive definite in outside the outer horizon of the Kerr solution. But if you start cranking this up, this region here where it is negative, it bulges out and comes out of the outer horizon. And now you have these regions where, for instance, the effective mass squared will be positive and negative depending on where you are in the plane. Yeah. And this effect gets quite dramatic as you increase the spin. So this is quite interesting because it leads you to the idea that remember that the effective mass is like so, and for Schwarzschild we needed eta to be positive because G is always positive definite there. But now you have the opposite possibility that if you spin the black hole sufficiently enough, you can have eta with the opposite sign because this is now negative, so you can have this negative as well to trigger an instability like the ones that I've presented to you before. So this at the linear level, this was analyzed by Dima and collaborators, and there are also a few other papers that came out following that. This picture also was done by Cherubini in this paper. So it turns out that you do have a tachyonic instability, very similarly to what I described to you for the Schwarzschild case. And then we analyze it, the non-linear solutions. And then you have this interesting feature of having a spin-induced scalarization. This was done with these collaborators. In the sense that now, if you fix the coupling constant, if you're below a certain value of the spin, your black hole in this theory will be identical to the Kerr solution. But if you spin it up a little bit more, it will become tachyonic unstable and develop a non-trivial scalar field configuration. So we analyzed this for this particular coupling constant. It's not quite the phi square model that I was showing to you before, but it's just because the collaborators had analyzed this case when in a previous paper. But basically what you have is the following. So let's look at this plot here. So this is the mass, and this is eta, a lambda, a coupling constant, which is equivalent to the lambda that I had before as a function of the dimensionless spin of the black hole, j over m squared. So you see that as long as you log above 0.5, you suddenly have the appearance of some solutions that live in here. So this is very similar to the band structure that I was showing to you in the Schwarzschild case. And this is followed by the appearance of a non-trivial amount of scalar charge as well as a function of the spin, as you can see here. So if you're below 0.5, this asymptotes to zero, And as you start increasing the spin, you have a non-zero value here. So I think I've been going a bit slow, so let me speed up and tell you a little bit more about what happens in the case of binaries. And then we can just, if you have more questions about the spin case, we can chat about it later. So let's focus from now on the binary case. So we did a first study exactly like this other things that I was describing to you, where we put a test scalar field on the background of a GR spacetime. In this case, it's the spacetime involving two black holes that we studied both head-on collisions of black holes and also binary in spirals. So we found four possibilities of processes that can happen when you have two black holes. So I'll use this notation. If when I say S, I mean that the black hole is scalarized, so you have some scalar here, and S bar is unscalarized. So we found that depending on the mass ratio between the two black holes and the value that you choose for the coupling constant, you can have a situation where two initially unscalarized black holes, they interact and they form an unscalarized remnant. You have the situation where you can have scalarized black hole, an unscalarized one, and it leads to an unscalarized remnant. There's also a possibility where scalarization happens throughout the process. And also this one where you start with two scalarized black holes and during the merger, for instance, the system loses its hair and forms a bald black hole as a remnant. For this, we use the Einstein toolkit together with the Canuda library, which was developed by Helvi Vitek, Miguel Zilion, Giuseppe Ficarra, and Matthew Ely. And we use it some machinery that was developed by Helvi in a previous paper where she studied this particular coupling. So let me show each of these four cases through videos, and it will be better to discuss each of these cases. So I forgot to say that all the videos that I'm going to show to you of the simulations that we run can be found on this website here, and also that the Canuda library developed by these folks has a YouTube channel. So if you want to watch the videos later, again, you can check it out there. Okay. So let's take a look on head-on collisions of black holes in this scalar Gauss-Bonnet theories. So let's look at first at this case here. So you have two unscalarized black holes. Let me stop the video. And then, so the mass ratio is equal to one, and I'm setting this coupling constant that I was calling eta, and then I call lambda, and now I'm calling beta again. Sorry for constantly changing the notation, but this is the same coupling constant between scalar field and Gauss-Bonnet. And I'm going to show you the equatorial plane where it plays two Schwarzschild black holes separated by 25 m. I put a Gaussian shell of scalar field, which is this color here that you can see. And yeah, you can see here from the column map. So it's the log of the absolute value of the scalar field that I'm denoting by capital phi now. And then this contour lines that you've seen here, they correspond to constant Gauss-Bonnet values on the plane. So this value here corresponds to Gauss-Bonnet equal to 1, 0.1, 0.2, no, sorry, 1, 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 2, and 10 to the minus 3. And then I let the two black holes collide, and we follow the evolution of the scalar field. So this is what I'm going to show here. So you see that the initial scalar field it completely disperses it because I'm choosing this to be equal to zero. So essentially you have a situation which is GR. But even if I were to put this value of beta 2 very small but non-zero, it will be very similar to what I told you in the Schwarzschild case, in which the black hole just interacted with the black hole and then it decayed off at late times. So this is what we are seeing here. So you have two S-bars black holes, and then they get closer. You'll see this, that the isocurvature levels of those Bonnet invariant, they take some interesting shapes, and in the end you form a non-rotating black hole here in the end. Let's take a look at this one here now, in which you start with a scalarized black hole, a non-scalarized one, and you end up with a non-scalarized remnant. And we use as initial data one of the bound states that I showed to you that could be formed in the Schwarzschild clay, in the Schwarzschild case, when you choose the coupling constant that I'm calling now beta to have an appropriate value. So in this case, let me go back. So we placed this bound state data around the two black holes. Now there's the mass ratio is non-one, it's not one. It's a half. And then you see that in this bigger black hole, the scalar field simply was shattered off very quickly because this black hole does not support this bound state data, but it does for the smaller one. So you could see that you see that it's dispersed here, but it stays around the smaller black hole through the collision process. In the end, you form an object with a mass which is bigger than the mass of the black hole that started here in this corner. And then you are not in this, and this final black hole cannot support the bound state anymore. And then it loses the hair. So this is this process here.
Okay. If I could interrupt and ask a question.
Yeah, sure.
Here, if I understood correctly, you're just solving like the linear test field equations.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And you have an unstable case, right? So if you put the black holes like farther apart, so they had more time before they merged, would the scalar field be exponentially larger? Because it's just going to sort of grow exponentially without
until
the black holes merge.
Yeah, that will be the case, and I'm going to show you in one of the next movies. Okay. In this particular case here, we tuned the value of beta to be such that the smaller black holes does support the scalar field. That's why you didn't see the this exponential growth, the scalar field just sits around the smaller black hole. So the next case, as we was referring to, is this one. Let's see, oops, it's out of order, so let me stop. So let's, okay, so I think this is one in which I'll have to exit for a moment because it wasn't playing when it's in full screen for some reason. So let's see. Okay, so we chose a value of beta such that each of the individual Schwarzschild black holes will trigger quite an instability of the final black hole. And it grows quite fast indeed. And you can see that by the fact that here, if you look at the scale, it grows quite fast, as Will was suggesting. But at the end, the remnant black hole has a mass in which it will support the bound state. And you see that the growth here on the column map stops after the merger happened. So even though you started with these two black holes which trigger an instability for the black hole, at the end when they merged, the mass is such that it supports this bound state configuration. Now there is one more case here. I think I'll play it in this screen mode just in case, in which you have the mass ratio is equal to one. And so we have two copies of two black holes that can support the scalar hair. And then after they merge, the mass increased, and then the Gauss-Bonnet invariant went down. And for this value of the coupling constant, you cannot support the bound state anymore. So you see that all the scalar field profile shed off after the collision. We can see this by looking at, just to make it closer to that plots that I showed to you for the Schwarzschild case, to make an analogy with that, I'm plotting essentially the equivalent of that, but the monopole, again, the monopole part of the scalar field at some observation point. We see that in all those cases, you have this decay of the scalar field, like this case is here, and where at the end you have this non-scalarized black hole. And in this case C, you saw that despite having this very strong instability, you still can form a bound state at the end. Now, we also performed a binary in spiral of the system. So this
sorry,
is what
I'll just to ask. For the KC, is that still growing exponentially? It's just a slower growth rate?
Yeah, so there is a little bit of, there is a slow growth rate, because during the collision, a little bit of the mass is lost in the form of gravitational waves. So the coupling constant that we use, it is actually a tiny bit above the critical value that you need for the remnant black hole to have a bound state. So there's a weak instability still happening, but okay, you could tune this
properly. Fine-tune the mass to be exactly at the marginal case between unstable and
stable. Yeah, Vantis would
the gravitational waves. It's okay.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah, one could play a little bit more with the beta such that, and fine-tune it such that it forms the, will be perfectly flat. So we're just a little bit above it in this plot. So I'm almost done. So this is the second to last slide, and I'll show you results for a binary in spiral that we did. So it's a quasi-circular simulation. Here we start with a Gaussian shell again. And then we place two black holes 10 m apart, and you have approximately 10 orbits before the merger. And I'm going to show you the mass ratio is equal to 1. And it will fall in this situation here where the value of beta is such that the initial black holes can form a bound state. And then after they merge, as we saw in the head-on case, in this case D, the remnant will lose its hair. So let's see if it plays. Okay, it did not, so exit again. And yeah. So I'm showing the same things as before. This curves here are constant Gauss-Bonnet values, the same ones that I've showed to you before. So the two black holes inspire. And you see that there is a scalar field living here on top of each of the black holes. It's 10 orbits, so it go a little bit slow. So maybe meanwhile, I can tell you a little bit about the gravitational wave signal that we observe. So this is for the monopole at some extraction radius. It has this profile. We saw that L equal M equal 2 modes are also excited, and they have this nice waveform. And this is just for reference the Psi 4, which since we are not backtracking the scalar field into the metric, it's identical to GR. So now the two black holes are almost at merging. You can see this by looking at the isochron curvature levels. So the Gauss-Bonnet has this nice, it wiggles in an interesting way. And then you're shedding off all the scalar field, noticed by the scale decreasing very quickly. And it has this very nice dipolar shape that you saw at the end. I don't know if I can, well, let me go back here, because I wanted to repeat the video, maybe just at the very end, which is the more interesting bit, I guess. But okay, so we can have an, it stop it? Well, okay, I'll play this in the question section. I'll leave it plain again after the present. So, okay, so this is what we have done in this latest paper. So we did a first analysis of what would happen in binary systems. Before this, all the previous work had been confined to isolated black holes. So let me conclude and pointing out some things which I think would be interesting for future work. So I hope that with this presentation, I was able to explain to you that by coupling scalar field with curvature invariance, you can have this effect of a spontaneous hair growth on black holes. So far, the study of isolated black holes has been quite well understood. There are a few things that could be explored further, in particular the formation of these black holes, for instance, doing collapse of dust or star within the spheres hasn't been done, and actually track the formation of the nonlinear evolution of the unstable Schwarzschild black hole to the scalarized black hole solution. And the instability, in particular of the rotating solutions, once you perturb it, hasn't been analyzed as well. So that could be something that would be interesting. I'm particularly interested in the binary dynamics, which I think it's a bit of the next frontier on this topic. So I showed you first results in this decoupling limit, in which I was just evolving scalar field on top of a GR background. But there's still a lot of work, in particular on the theoretical side, on finding a well-posed formulation for this theory. And I know that Will and Justin Ripley have been working on this. And there are other works by Kovacs, Rao, and Papalo on this direction. Helvi Vitek as well has been working hard on this. And of course, this will lead to code development after this part has been done. Ultimately, it will be very nice to have gravitational waveforms such that we can confront this type of effect against actual observational data. And it will be interesting to see if other types of spontaneous growth of other fields could happen, for instance, vectorization, tensorization. So with this, I'll finish here.
Yeah, thank you, Hector, for the nice talk. Any questions? So in the conclusion, you're mentioning that you want to construct a waveform, right? Like, but the simulation, if I understand correctly, it's like a perturbative evolution, right? Like
exactly.
Back reaction. So how do you get the back reactive waveform on this?
Yeah, so for this we would still have to address the question of how to back react the scalar field onto the metric, which would fall in this category here of theoretical development.
Okay.
Note that Will and Justin Ripley put out a paper not long ago analyzing this. But okay. My understanding is that we still need more work on this front to be able to have a full gravitational waveforms. Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions?
So if you have, do you know enough of this theory that to say something about, so this theory is black hole, those rotating black holes are different from Kerr. So can you try and already set some limits based on current observations as to the availability of the—
Yeah, I think there was a paper not long ago by Enrico Barauze and his postdocs in which they tried, I think they placed a bound on this coupling eta from the Event Horizon Telescope by analyzing how the scalarized solutions would affect the shadow. But I don't remember the values that they put, but this was definitely looked at by Enrico, Sebastian Vogel, and Nicola Franchini. I don't remember the value of.
I see. Thank you.
But I mean, in principle, the InSpar waveform, right? You can write down the modification in this PPE, whatever formalism, and you maybe be able to already get some constraint from the InSpar waveform, right?
It could be in principle, yes. You could modify the PPE waveform to include scalarization or descalarization, as we have seen here, that the scalar field loses the hair during the evolution. But at the moment, it's hard to say, oh, this effect takes place when the orbital frequency is this value, for instance. And this will depend on the coupling constant and the mass of the black hole. So it's not clear yet. We are doing a more extensive exploration of the binary problem at the moment. So we are exploring the parameter space quite a bit now. And also we are looking at the opposite sign of beta, because the remnant of this binary evolutions is a black hole with spins above 0.5, typically 0.7, which means that you would fall quite well within the regime in which you could have spin-induced scalarization. So one of the things that we are studying now with Helvi Vitek, her student, Matthew Ellie, and also with Nico Yunus is this possibility of having binary evolutions where you have Schwarzschild black holes throughout evolution, simply because they do not support hair if beta is negative, because the Gauss boundary of each individual black hole is positive definite. And then only after the merger, once you form the Kerr black hole, you could activate the instability and form the bound state at the end. So it'd be quite interesting to look at this in a little bit more details, because depending on the instability timescale, it could be that this affects the ring down, or if the instability timescale is very low, it could be that you would see something that looks completely GR, and only at late times after the merger, the scalar hair would actually appear, but you will not see this through your gravitational wave detection, for instance. So there's.
And what would you know already? Can you not say that? I mean, is this a complicated calculation, or is it not a one page kind of thing based on what you know already?
We are exploring this with a wide set of simulations. But our expectation is that indeed that this would happen for the reason that I said about the spin of the remnant black hole. But these are simulations that are ongoing, but
I understand. But you mentioned the time scale. So the times you could estimate what the time scale would be to conclude where you had a chance of it being just like GR, and then later on it changes or messing up things in between.
Yeah, we have tried to do so. The problem is this would, let me see. Okay, so the way that I've attempted to tackle the problem is to try some, for instance, separation of variables of the box phi equation on top of the Kerr background. But it quickly becomes very hard because the Gauss-Bonnet has this complicated function of the cosines, and there's not a way of decoupling the equation to do something very simple as in the Schwarzschild-like simulations that I showed to you.
I see, thank you.
In the Kerr problem, yeah, you have to deal with mode coupling and so on. And all of this was examined in more details in this paper by Dima et al. And for instance, one of the things that they found is that all the modes contribute to the instability. There's not a single mode which is the dominant to the instability. So it's a little bit hard to do a quick calculation of the instability, but we did try this.
Yeah, thanks.
That's interesting. Are you saying that
it's not known what the even linear instability of a Kerr black hole is in this theory?
The instability rate? So the instability rate has been studied by DiMa, but the thing is that all these calculations were done by fully numerically, like analytically, there hasn't been a calculation like so.
But do they not just have like a number
for a spin 0.7 black hole you can just apply?
Sorry, can you repeat?
Do they not just have a number for what the instability rate is for a spin 0.7 black hole as a function of the coupling that you can plug in?
That's a good question. I don't remember if they showed this in the paper. I would have to take a look. But they might. I don't know. I don't remember from the top of my head. Yeah. I'll have to check the paper.
Well, in principle, you should be able to still compute the linear mode frequency, right? Both the real and imagined part.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, doing a time domain evolution, in principle, you should be able to do a calculation like this and then infer it in the instability time scale from the growth here. Like have a counterpart from this Schwarzschild plot to the Kerr plot. But I don't remember, as I said, if they did this in this paper. Yeah, so.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, if not, let's thank Hector again.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for the questions.